The Ryan Tubridy Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our broadband, your world is limitless. Live beyond.
Well, my guest this morning at 28 minutes past nine began his film career with a letter to the award-winning film director Ken Loach, who told him to stop by for a cup of tea and a chat if he ever was in London. He did, and their working relationship went on to become one of the strongest and most prolific in cinema. The screenwriter Paul Laverty joins us now for the first time. We were doing our maths. It's 13 years since we last spoke. Can you believe that?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, in a window, in a shop window in Cork City.
for the window shakes the barrel.
The very one.
Great memories of Cork. Great memories of that film.
We might as well, just as we're talking about before we get stuck into the Sorry We Missed You, The Wind That Shakes the Barley. I think in some ways it started a movement in this country in terms of a time when we could actually look at the history of our island without the hysteria of paramilitary excess north of the border. Does that make sense?
Yeah, but what it led to was the hysteria of people like Gove, Michael Gove, who's now right at the heart of government.
Did he get stuck into it?
Oh, he went absolutely crazy, absolutely bonkers when he won the Palme d'Or.
What did he say?
Basically what he said was, he stood history in its head and he got furious. I actually hadn't seen the film, but that didn't stop him writing about it.
Yeah,
and basically it was interesting because he said, the Republicans have always, had a peaceful way out, but they've always chosen the violent path. But what happened in The Wind That Shakes the Barley? 1918, Sinn Féin had a majority to leave the British Empire.
Yeah.
We know the story there. They had a majority. They were repressed, led to the War of Independence. And he couldn't stand the fact that we reminded them of that democratic vote in 1918, and he just went furious. And then he went on to be Minister of Education. So there, he just shows you what type of people we've got at the heart of the British government.
You do well not to trust them, don't you? Well, there you are. He's Minister for what, essentially Brexit or the Duchy of Lancashire or some other archaic expression. Yeah. In the London Times.
Some picture that, isn't it? Boris Johnson, Mogg, and Michael Gove. So you do well not to trust them.
Wouldn't you? In the London Times, I just see this piece from before. Gove questioned how British people could cheer for a director, as we were talking about there, Ken Loach, who portrays British soldiers as subhuman mercenaries burning thatched cottages, torturing by using pliers to rip out toenails and committing extreme violence against women. Or as we like to call it, the truth.
Well, this is the man who opposed the Good Friday Agreement.
Yeah.
And so the idea that these opportunists and mavericks, are in the heart of government just now, I think that really must raise a warning sign. This is actually, way transcends Brexit. Because if Johnson playing his Hollywood role just now, like the Incredible Hulk, as he says, pretending to be Rocky Balboa, lying his way through, backed by the popular press, and he presents himself as a hero. I mean, can you imagine the deals he'll do with the United States? I mean, we'll look at the corporate power already, the influence they have. Can you imagine him rolling out the red carpet? That's his words when he went over to the States. So I think we're coming up to a real big crisis, which totally transcends Brexit, and in fact leads us very nicely onto our film, I think.
It does. Although you're giving me anxiety, not that I don't do anxiety in any meaningful way, the way some people do, which is not easy for them. I get that entirely, but it's just, look at the news this morning, and we thought there was hope, and now the DUP have said they don't like what they see. Not a huge shock there, I suppose. But we would hope we're on the cusp of something. But it does lead back to your film that I saw yesterday. Sorry, we missed you. Do you want to give us the blurb at the back of the book? Would that allow us to get stuck into it?
Yes, well, I mean, first and foremost, Ryan, it's a story about a family, a very ordinary family who love each other. Mm. As a mum, she's a care worker, and the father drives a white van. There's a teenage boy of 15 actually, and his sister Liza Jane, and so it's a very intimate story of how these four people live and interact, and how they don't really see their parents because the mum's in zero contract. She goes out early in the morning to look after older people, then she has many hours free during the day. Then she does lunch for them, many hours free during the day again, for which she doesn't get paid. And then she does the tuck-ins at night time. And what you see is an extended working day, zero-hour contracts, very vulnerable, not being home with her children, and not getting paid for travel time. And no wonder, I don't know how it is here in Ireland, but there's a massive crisis right at the heart of care in the UK. And the more I travel around Europe, just back from Paris as well, the other day there, talking to 1,100 activists, it's the same story again, precarious work. The father is a white van driver. And what has been wonderful about how this new liberal model works, it's so versatile, it's sculpted, you know, a kind of a framework where people believe that they're warriors, enterprise workers who believe they're in charge of their own business. They have their own vans. And Amazon is right at the heart of this, of course. And what it means is all risk is transferred from the company to the worker. So no holidays, no sick care. They bear the brunt if there's any accident. And again, so they believe that they're warriors of the road, you know, they're right at the heart of the enterprise culture. But what they're doing is carrying the burden, which, you know, a company should do. So what we see is people being, you know, in precarious work, tied to an app, incredible control over their own lives. And before you know it, you don't see your own children, which in the film really begs the question, what is the point of work if you can't actually see your own children? And in the old days, you know, we are of a generation who remember if somebody actually worked, they might not be rich, but at least, you know, you could plan your life, there was some security. But now, what was really fascinating, and this is what we found out after, we went around the food banks for I, Daniel Blake, the amount of the working poor was really unbelievable who were going to the food banks. And now the statistics have backed this out. 3 out of 4 children in poverty in the UK have at least one working parent. So that old contract where you worked and got yourself out of poverty no longer exists. So I think there's a massive existential crisis right at the heart of the workplace just now.
Okay, you've covered a multitude there, and within the film, let us go to focus on let's say the wife in this piece. Yes. Mm-hmm. She's the care worker.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Kindness coming from every cell in her body. She's a kind person. The way she treats the older people she's looking after, even if they're getting, in their senility, cruel, nasty and loud, if they're knocking plates onto the ground, if she has to change the nappies and so forth. Mm. And so forth. And she's on the bus because she had to sell the car in order for the husband to buy the white van. It's relentless. I noticed that almost like the supporting cast are the bags under the eyes of the lead roles.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean by that? They're so tired and so weary and yet loving.
Well, I mean, it's really fascinating, Ryan. I'm glad you picked up on that, really, because, you know, obviously that there's a crisis in care work, and you hear horror stories, you know, when I did the research.
Mm.
But talking to the carers, these people were not doing it for money. I met some absolutely remarkable, it was mostly women, absolutely brilliant women. You know, and I said, well, I try to treat them as I would my mother.
Yeah, it says that. Yeah,
yeah, and that's a line from a carer.
You'd never leave your mother in a situation like that, and therefore,
And they were incredible. And the dedication, they said, you know, not only that, and they were furious at their own bosses because they would change staff, and people who are older and easily confused or have got dementia or pre-dementia, you know, being confused by a different face, they say, no, they've got the right to see the same face. You know, and so that's the workers are saying, like, I know my work, and it's an incredibly complex job. All the medicines, the patients, cleaning them, some people have got wounds, you know, and so I found really remarkable, brilliant people doing this. And then, of course, you heard of terrible horror stories too.
Yes.
You know, people left on their own, the central heat not turned on, people doubly incontinent, you know, being forgotten about, you know, because, you know, the system just does not work. It's all subcontracted. Many have been taken over by equity funds. And so what you see is a system that doesn't work.
Let's go to the main man, as it were, which is Ricky Turner, played by Chris Hitchin. So from the get-go, as soon as I saw him in the garage looking to buy the forecourt to buy the white van, I knew he was doomed. Because I've seen your movies. This is not a happy ending material, right? So I knew, and I saw the
spoiler alert. Yeah,
well, spoiler alert.
The next one's a comedy, I swear, Ryan. Yeah,
someday, we'll get to that. Spoiler alert, Paul wrote it.
I think there's a few moments of mirth in it. Yeah.
Oh, crikey, tell me where they were. I missed them. No, we'll go into it while I was like, but when I saw the prices in the window of the car, of the vans, I thought, okay, now we're into 14 grand, 13 grand. But he goes to the warehouse, and the boss man, the big fella, turns around essentially and says, here's your, what's that machine that they have?
Well, they call it a gun or a scanner, a handheld device.
Right, so you see delivery people come to your house, your office, and they have the scanner. And that's their lifeline to the central system.
Yes,
and your man essentially says to him, you lose this, you're dead. You miss a turn, you're dead. You miss a delivery, you're dead. Mm. You don't miss. And then one of his colleagues hands him a plastic bottle, empty bottle, and says, take that. What do I need this for? That's your toilet break. Mm. Like, stark. And now, from the get-go then, he's the running man. Yeah. He can't breathe or take a moment or worry about his family. We'll get to that in a second. It's relentless. And that's the gig economy.
Well, we could only write that, Ryan, because I've been with them.
Yeah.
You know, and it was actually, even for Daniel Blake, I found whistleblowers inside the Department of Welfare. It was easier to do that. For this film, it was much harder because these people are working so hard, so long hours, they're in a van, they're driving about, and they're exhausted. Mm. So actually to find them and to speak to them and to spend time with them was really difficult. So eventually I just went to depots, I went to car parks, and I went early in the morning and I came back and I spoke to them afterwards. And then I started speaking to them. Then I got to know some of them. Some of them were kind enough and brave enough to let me come with them. So I did the parcels with them. So if you spend a day with someone who's on the run the whole time, then you see the plastic bottle, you know? I mean, I remember one lad actually bought him his lunch, a couple of sandwiches, you know? And he was surviving on high-energy drinks, and he simply didn't have time to eat a sandwich because the thing was bleeping, he had to hit his preciser. If you don't get your precisers, you get penalty points, you know? And so when you see that man at the end of his day, and you can see the greyness in his eye. And then, you know, all sorts of complications take place. You know, over in some places, with airports flying over, a plane will maybe do something to the connection with his handheld device. Or there's a delay, or there's a road, or there's an accident, or somebody's not in, or somebody doesn't do something else, or somebody complains, and you just see them just being pounded and pounded and pounded. And then you see the photographs of their kids, you know, stuck to the, you know, the front bench of their van. You know, and then you speak to them, well, when did you see them? You know, and he's rushing to get back maybe in time. You know, and then it's the devil is always in the detail.
Yes.
Talk to one Amazon driver. He says, you know, Amazon will tell you they book on at such and such a time, they'll show the technology. When you go in with them and you speak to them, no, I've got to leave at such and such an hour to avoid the traffic. I've got to be in the holding car park 2 hours before so I go out in the first wave. You know, all of that unpaid.
And you want to get the right route.
The right route, and then the changes, and you know, so no wonder Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world. In fact, I actually showed one of the drivers by some strange quirk of fate. The newspaper came, it was a change in shares, and he overtook Bill Gates as the richest man in the world. And this guy was running around sweating. His face was, you know, he was grey with tiredness. Yeah. I said, do you know who that is? Jeff Bezos. And, you know, and he's the richest man in the world. And you can just see this man saying, right, the penny dropped. You know, he's monitoring every single second, tied to an algorithm, you know, to make profit. And no wonder, this is amazing, Ryan. I bought the New York Times just yesterday in the plane. They're talking about capitalism being in a crisis. 2 weeks ago, the Financial Times had a big front page supplement stuck to their paper because they say the inequality in this neoliberal system just now, you know, might bring the whole thing down. So they're saying, let's regulate it. You know, let's tame it. Let's try and humanise it. But of course, I mean, that's like trying to tame a tiger.
But wouldn't you love to put Jeff Bezos in a van for a day and say, because just to that, I'm not trying to do an anti-Bezos. I don't have an opinion on this. But I'm just saying that if he got a whiff of the, you know, the urine stained bottle and the pressure, the half a sandwich, I wonder would he go, oh, we need to change, because I'm sure he's not a bad guy, but he needs to be in the inside of that van.
Well, I would love to give him and his executives a plastic bottle and tie them up inside their executive office and say, okay, no toilet breaks for you, mate. Yeah. You know, because you're mathematicians, you're algorithm experts, you're information technologists, monitor the moments and the steps of every single one of your hundreds of thousands of workers. And surprise, surprise, do they have toilet breaks? No, they don't.
Well, this
I would take issue. This man knows. He knows how to make money. He's got to win the competition. It's in the nature of the beast. And that's why I think it can't be tamed. And now I really think we're coming to the... We're talking about climate change. I mean, how mad can it be that we're having vapes and shirts and T-shirts and socks being delivered by one exploited driver in a white van all around it's happening in the States, it's happening all around Europe.
Yeah.
It's mad. So I think we have to say, no, this market system does not work. Now, we let them off in 2008. There was a financial crisis. They're back to doing their same tricks. They're giving out bigger bonuses than they've ever done before. 8 people now own the same as 50% of the world's population. Yeah. And I think people have to say, no, you're not doing this to our families. You're not doing this to our communities. So I think it really begs the question, how do we take back power? How do we change the plan of ownership, and we can't let them away with it. Abby at the end of the film goes, how do you get away with it?
Yes.
You know, and that's what they're fearful of too. That's what the Financial Times is scared of. That's what the New York Times is scared of. Mm-hmm. And we are far too conservative, far too fearful. And we have to get together with our young people who are showing brilliant example of militancy because their lives have been screwed. They've been given, they can't buy their houses, they can't have serious work, they can't build their families. Yeah. And I'm hearing these stories all around Europe. Mm. And there really is a time now to say, right, no more. We are going to use our imagination. We're going to find new ways of dealing with our economy so we have control of it and we're not dictated and sending all that money back to the States. And these bandits never even pay their taxes. And you know that about in Ireland more than anyone.
Well, that's another discussion, no question.
A very good one. About time you paid up. And what's the government? I mean, it's like a Monty Python scene. They're appealing a decision of taxes going to, you know, European taxpayers. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's like something out of the Life of Brian.
Well, it does seem, you know, who's answerable? It feels like the adults have left the room in the world at the moment. I don't know where anyone is or who's in charge. And if you, for example, if you look at Twitter or Facebook or these kind of places, they kind of seem to operate a little bit in the shadows. It's hard to find responsibility, or at least they'll say, print everything. Kids are being bullied, people are being shamed, and it's very hard to find out who's going to take responsibility. But before we talk about any more of that, let me ask you about the children in the film. There's a young, there's a teenage boy who is going off the rails because, again, there's no, dare I say it, adult in the room because they're working their backsides off. There's the young girl, she's 11 years old, who becomes the carer, essentially. Who cares for the carer? The answer is the daughter, because she comes in from school, she's making her cereal or whatever, she's listening to the muffled rows that are born out of exhaustion, not out of hate.
Thanks, Ryan. I think that's really perceptive, really. And I think this little kid, you know, is really special. I mean, she was special in my imagination, you know, when she came to mind, but we found little Katie. And she, I mean, she was just a remarkable child.
Really?
So smart. She was top of the class for absolutely everything. I mean, she could turn her hand to anything. And she had a kind of an emotional kind of connection with people. And so we were so lucky to find her and the young lad, Reese. But you're right. I mean, I think she's actually much more emotionally intelligent than her father, for example. You know, and she's seen all the arguments. You know, she's saying that people are tired. She comes back in and, you know, she sees her mum and dad exhausted in front of the television with a takeaway meal. And she starts putting things away.
At 11 p.m.
Yeah, 11.
School the next day. Yeah,
school the next day. Yeah. I mean, fortunately, she's a brilliant kid, you know, and she's going to be good at her homework. But why are we doing this to our kids? I mean, this is not an accident. This is the tail end of, you know, of a gig economy where trade unions have been wiped out, where there's been massive privatisation of absolutely everything. And at the very tail end of it, we see how this plays out, you know, with zero-hour contracts in the lives of one delicate family.
Yes.
And this is a family that loves each other. I mean, in another, they haven't got problems. So you can imagine families that have got a little, you know, other problems to deal with, health or mental health. I mean, they are going to be absolutely decimated and destroyed. But this is a family that loves each other, and this is the consequence and the logic of a system that really destroys people's lives.
There's an expression we use a lot in the programme, which is about, you never know who you're sitting beside on the bus, you know. You just never know, or the cranky person who won't let you out in front of them in the car or whatever. You should give them the benefit of the doubt that they might be having a terrible day, there could be something wrong. And then, if not, they're just rude, and that's unfortunate. Yes. My point being, I suppose, that when a white van comes outside your door, when Just Eat or Deliveroo are bringing in your latest curry or whatever it might be, you probably have to second guess. I'm not having to go at the firms. I'm just saying, in terms of humanity, the person handing you that the goods over, we need to, as humans, be engaging and be kind and say thank you for that, or maybe even say, where are you from, or what are you up to, and that kind of thing. It might sound patronising, but I actually mean, I want to get back to what I said at the beginning of the programme, civil discourse.
Yes,
it's got to be a start.
The great problem is, if you engage them, because the system is so stacked up against them, you know, just that ordinary discourse eats into their time and they're under even more pressure. That's the thing. But you're right. I think the next step, Ryan, is to have curiosity about people's lives and what's happening and, you know, how they're operating and how they're being paid.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the same for our carers. You know, I met brilliant carers, you know, who couldn't afford to continue with their job because they had to pay for their own travel, 0-hour contracts. So many families in need with an old parent are losing great carers because they can't afford to do this job. So, I mean, I think we need to have civic curiosity.
Yeah, I love that expression, and I agree with you. A text says, tell youngsters, I don't know why I say youngsters, tell everyone, but to stop buying online because they're wrecking things for themselves and soon there'll be no shops and no real jobs. I mean, there is that danger. That local shop is closing. I mean, you see it all around towns and villages in Ireland. I'm not sure if it's the same in Scotland, but or the UK broadly speaking. And yet you don't want to be necessarily a dinosaur or, you know, you don't want to be out of step with the times. So what's it's the balance, is it? Or?
Yeah, Ryan, I mean, it's a very good point and a good point by your caller, really. I've just gone round the northeast of England just very recently. You know, you go and see the town centres, they are dead. The libraries are closing, the churches are closing, all the community centres are closing. All this was after austerity. The pubs are closing, places where people meet are closing, all the projects for youngsters are closing. And then they're surprised at knife crime in the UK when you everything, all the civic infrastructure is drawn away because they're leaving it again to the market.
Paulus.
The market does not work, and unless we challenge that paradigm, we are screwed, and it's going to destroy our communities and the lives of tens of millions of our citizens.
Paulus says, I was at a meeting last night concerning low pay in the hospitality sector, which I know you talk to people in that sector with regard to this film, and some of the horror stories she says I listened to were so sad, mostly non-Irish, women mostly, again abused by the bosses. She asks, what have we become? Kath says, are the younger population not the worst offenders in consumerism, online shopping, and lack of knowledge or concern for poorer children enslaved and being exploited? And then again, I would argue that it's not just younger population. I think it's wholesale. Another from a text says, my son has a good job with a multinational, well paid, but his working conditions are not far from those of a member of the gig economy. He never knocks off work, sees little of his children, and is under constant stress. He travels abroad for work, but is never compensated for his travel time, and I worry about the effects on his health and his relationship with his family. It is a dark time for workers.
Yeah, and I mean, you can see again that anxiousness everywhere. I mean, the stories here in Ireland, the stories are here in the UK.
Yeah.
We were in France there, we talked to 1,100 activists just to say the other night there. And it's the same story.
It's universal,
It's precariousness, they're frightened, the unions have been destroyed.
Yeah.
Everything is on their terms. You know, you're the end of a telephone whether you get work on a telephone, as it shows you a dinosaur arm. You know, a text whether you get a job the next day. People are frightened and isolated. You know, and now we have this system now which extracts so much surplus from the economy. And there's such inequality. And so there's only one way to deal with that is to take power back from them. Frederick Douglass, the great slave, he said, power concedes nothing without demand. It never did and it never will. You know, so it's all right. We can change our shopping patterns. It's going to, you know, just it's piss more around the edges. We have to go back to radical questions. Communities have to demand of their politicians that they're brave and we have an imaginative solutions to taking back control out of our economies. Because if we don't do that, all we'll do is we'll just be complaining.
Well, interesting you should mention Frederick Douglass, who, of course, had great time for Daniel O'Connell, who
he did,
we
yes.
knew as the liberator. Maybe it's time to liberate ourselves from such
and
chains.
Liberate our minds first, because I think, you know, questions and narratives are in our minds. Margaret Thatcher was a genius. Her and Nicholas Ridley and Keith Joseph, they sold they sold the narrative, we must be independent, we must look after our families, you know, it's all about free choice.
Yeah.
And now we have to say, we're all in this together, our communities have to take back control, we have to find new narratives and new stories, and we have to have confidence, and we have to trust our young people and their brilliant way of finding new ways to take control of our lives again. Yeah. Otherwise, we're going to be screwed.
I'm laughing, thinking, in a sardonic way, I suppose, how two guests I've spoken to recently singing the praises of Mrs. Thatcher.
Oh, I don't sing her praises.
No, I know that you don't.
Yes,
But I'm just showing the nature of the world we live in.
Yes, and if only the left were as radical and as clear-sighted
as the right.
As the right were, because Johnson will bury so many people if he takes control, and he'll be doing deals with his friends across the Atlantic, and you'll see more misery and more complaints like that.
Well, there you are. The two names I'm mentioning were Jeffrey Archer and John Bercow in the last 2 weeks. So there you are. That's it. You have your own civil war going on in the UK, I think.
I'm just going to say one thing too, Ryan, because people always, I'm not a member of the Labour Party, but I was at the Labour Party conference presenting our film, and actually there's some great new things going on there, but we don't hear about, taking back control of utilities, which is actually very, very popular according to the opinion polls, giving trade unions back their rights. And Corbyn has been absolutely decimated and attacked because I think capital realises that him and John McDonald are a danger to corporate power. And I think that's why there's such vicious attacks against them.
Interesting times, to say the very least. Yeah. Your film, Sorry We Missed You, written by yourself, directed by Ken Loach, the word I'd use is devastating. It got right under my skin, and I think that's where you want your films to be. Mm-hmm. So congratulations on
Thanks,
that.
Ryan.
I really enjoyed seeing you again. Don't leave it so long. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Likewise.
Tomorrow's Friday, so it's Friday, 2 or 3 weeks. It's the 1st of November.
Yes.
The film will be released here. Aye. And it is, as I say, it's a salutary tale for our times, grim but necessary. Paul Laverty, thanks for your time today.
Great pleasure, Ryan. Thank you.